to fill in for him to introduce Nick, since Peter's out of town. I think, you know, to many of you, Nick doesn't need any introduction, but I'll do it anyhow, since I think many of you, if not most of you, know Nick. Nick spent over 10 years in the health software industry, completed his MS in biomedical informatics at Oregon Health Sciences, and his PhD with us in 2004?
Seven.
So I thought. That's, yeah. Master's in 2004. So his research focuses on social and technical issues in the design, development, implementation of clinical and translational research systems, including user needs evaluation to support usability, policy associated with biological data banks, bioinformatic workflows, personal health information management, decision analysis, cross-institutional clinical data sharing. I'm not sure what Nick is not interested in and has expertise in.
Less interested in CA Grid.
Including some of his funded projects that he's working on are related to biospecimen discovery and sharing, federated data discovery, and ethics and data sharing. And I should mention, he not only is an assistant professor in our department in Division of Biomedical and Health Informatics, but he has an adjunct appointment in bioethics and humanities.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred.
Yes, so this is a very different from the CA Big discussion last, and this is kind of an evolution of a series of meetings and research projects that I've been working on for a while now that is sort of more in the social, technical, and someone I think accused me of going to the soft side once, which is fine. But this is about the policies and processes to make some of the large-scale clinical research systems we are building actually available and used, and such that we all retain the ability to use them and they actually make impact. So, So today I'm just going to quickly go over a few things. First, I'm going to talk about the evolving why and what of research clinical data sharing as it is existing across the systems, technologies, and drivers in this country. This is national, mostly. Then I'm going to do a discussion of the policy and practice of how this is being implemented, risks, and approaches there. And then I'm going to describe a system that I actually have been running for a couple of years now that is now in an evolutionary state, which is a cross-institutional collaboration that is trying to implement some of these practices and has learned from some of the challenges. So there are incredible national expectations to increase data sharing right now. AHRQ has sunk $1 billion into this, the NIH, NCRR, the CTSA components, Office of National Coordinator, High Tech Act, all of these are behind the very oversimplified rubric of increased data sharing. But data sharing has been, I think, overused the way that translational is overused or anything has been overused lately. It should be delved into more deeply. But against this, we also have increased law to assess. So new privacy disclosures can significantly affect community trust. So if we have systems that share data, we don't only have only ourselves to worry about, we have the communities and patients we represent. And these new challenges and risks associated with privacy breaches have punitive damages to researchers, institutions, and they haven't fully been tested, but they're expected to be used as demonstrations fairly soon. One part of increasing data sharing is about increasing trustworthiness in clinical research or in research itself. As we move from a very relatively insular, isolated, siloed clinical research environment to larger scale effects and multiple interdisciplinary approaches, we have to understand about what it means to actually have research that is supported, perceived as trustworthy, and is actually stewarding its purpose and our use of funds and community goodwill. But, of course, on top of that, we need to reset some presently low expectations. I love this title from this New York Times article that came out a month ago. Rare sharing of data leads to results in Alzheimer's. Now, this isn't sharing of data about rare Alzheimer's diseases. This is so unique that they decided to pull it out as an example of how sharing actually helps. Now, you dig into this, turns out this is a $40 million effort. This is a rare-sharing, well-funded effort, but it is very powerful, and I recommend you take a look at that. If you look down the next two articles there, data shameful neglect. This is about how sharing is, though, increasingly mandated and supported. It's not really enacted or used by researchers. That empty archives, these initiatives to build large-scale aggregate archives, with rare exceptions, remain underutilized. And in part, they remain underutilized because we're still working towards standards to commingle data, to make it relevant, to make it useful, to make the researchers themselves trust the resources and their time. And in part, it's protection, it's de-identification, it's security, it's privacy, and it's just modalities of doing these policies to support data sharing. And finally, you know, this is Newsweek 2010, desperately seeking cures. And there's been a whole series of these lay press articles of like, you know, we have so much, we are not seeing the traction because we remain, for one reason or another, relatively isolated in how we reuse secondary data and how we do build collaborations. And so George Church, somewhat infamous, but a very leading genomic scientist, says that, you know, somebody has to share. If we all hold on to it, we all lose it. And I think that's obviously the principle. I don't think anyone really agrees. It's like mom and apple pie. We should be able to share data, right? I mean, it's important to do, but we aren't really. So the problem is that when you get down to this data sharing phrase, you immediately start hitting barriers. So first it's like, you know, what do you mean share? What, sharing what exactly? Then you get down to further details. Who actually owns repositories? Who owns the data in the repositories? Who owns the derivative data in the repositories? And who owns the obligation to downstream secondary users of the data in the repositories? I as a patient have some ownership of what I might submit in a de-identified way. I as a repository owner, and I have one, have some ownership of the de-identified data through my funding mechanism, but I don't know what obligation I have or I can give to sending it to someone else yet. I don't know how they would use it, and I don't know, frankly, what rubric I would use to test whether they should use it. So what are the trade-offs, though, in order to protect these things? There is a trade-off between identifiability, research protection, and research utility. And these are very nuanced, and this is a very fast-moving field. There is often the question, is there a precedent? And, you know, we see from the CA Big discussions that, yes, there are some precedents, but are they being used? I mean, every CA Big discussion we've had this last five sessions has been, is it being used? Well, if there's a precedent, sure. Is it generalizable? Does it matter? Can you generalize one use of data policy and data sharing to different uses in academic or institutional or public private partnerships? Does the patient community have a say in this? You know, the repository that I have right now is approaching 4.2 million patients de-identified, so not human subjects. So technically, no, they don't have a say, but maybe they should. Does the city, state, or government care have a say? Well, one of the big things in data sharing around this country now is that state by state, you have the attorney generals weighing in at different levels of involvement. In state like Massachusetts or Minnesota, you have a great deal of support for consenting and other methodologies to underlie policy for data sharing. Washington state, we have a lot higher research restrictions. So these are some of the things that surround the concept. And so, to go kind of more deeply into, these are some of the modes that are beginning to be evolved. So we're probably all familiar with the no data sharing mode. This is essentially can be characterized as a researcher-driven clinical trial by which they gain consent from patients, they capture information from the patients, they do their research on it, and they publish. They don't, and they're not allowed to, typically share data with secondary uses. They don't have consent for it in most cases. They may not want to because of intellectual property reasons, and they don't know how to talk to the patients or even really realistically do it. Oftentimes they're building their own systems. These are de novo. They don't have a good structure for anything like that. But from this, there's beginning to be the beginning of inter-investigator data sharing. So these might be the owner of repositories, be it biorepositories, registries, things like that, where the argument to share it is beginning to outweigh the problems of it. But a lot of this is still in terms very informal of how they establish what could be the method for doing this. Then there's this thing that I'm generally heading down the direction of, which is federated institutional, where institutions have ownership of data and they wish to seek to share it to build comparative effectiveness research registries or cohort discovery or pharmacovigilance sites, things like that, and they're trying to formalize how this might happen. There are grid-based collaborations, which we've seen some of, which we'll be seeing more from March next week in the 591, on how security is beginning to provide some structure for supporting data sharing collaborations in that that word. And then these more kind of novel versions that are really coming along quickly. So research institution to community patient. It's like, you know, how we would hypothetically share a data resource that is specifically to involve and engage the community themselves, have them participate in the process. This is very dangerous to consider because institutions do not like to, for example, being proven wrong. And going from there, I'm sorry, Matt.
A question for you. How would you differentiate federated and grid-based collaborations? Is it just a question of scale or technology stack?
Both. I would say right now the easiest way to distinguish them is that the federated networks presently don't have the concept of common registration, is that they're ad hoc, they're fault tolerant, and I'll get into that in a minute, versus the grid thing so far is that you need to have some upfront expected collaborative mechanism that drives your participation in it, and it's both technical and at some level policy. So. And then finally, there's this federal mandate, and this is a really crazy one, is that dbGaP, which is in dbGaP 2 now, is now likely moving towards a policy that any high-throughput genomic screenings, such as exome sequencing, researchers who have this data will have to submit this to dbGaP before they get to analyze the data. And then they get the data back from the repository after they ask for it. So it's a blinded one way, but this is conditions of funding, and this is very, very strange because it means that everyone will get equal opportunity to petition for access to data at a certain level, but you as the researcher presumably will not necessarily have that first attempt. So it's changing structure. So the drivers, you know, and we're seeing why the bottom four or five at least are there, is that, you know, large population sets are fairly unarguably important to be able to study how to manage them. New analysis techniques are allowing us to analyze large population sets. These are things that we couldn't do when we were in the lab 25 years ago very well. And now, you know, genome-wide association, exome sequencing, things like dbGaP and others are really providing those possibilities. Federal mandates, you know, HIPAA, HITECH, ARA, and all the rest, and sorry, HITECH and ARA and ONC, this was the condition of funding, is that this needs to have a common benefit. We float everybody's boat. And finally, community pressure. You know, I was at a conference, a Seattle City Club conference yesterday which was to community citizens in Seattle, UW researchers, Fred Hutch and others, which is about who owns your DNA. There's a lot of community interest in trying to determine what reasons we're doing this. Now, there's usually a lot of support behind it, but these things are affecting constituencies, affecting representatives, are affecting policy, affecting funding, and you know, I think we'll see a lot more of that. But in this data sharing world, there's sort of opposite directions evolving. There is a very long, very storied history in approaching greater de-identification and more enhanced security efforts. So this is, you know, this is typical of large scale efforts. So community, you know, data repositories. Genome-wide association studies, dbGaP, things like that, clinical research and problems like what I have. And these are kind of characterized when there's limited understanding of who might be using these downstream and limited connection, because if you have a large number of patients, realistically, you can begin to, you know, think of them as data aggregates. And one of my colleagues mentioned one thing to me the other day that I like a lot, is that there is the perception in these large-scale de-identified efforts that we begin to think of patients as dreams or dots. They're either the dream of what represents a real human or just a dot, which is on a matrix. But this is the approach we're moving towards, degraded de-identification. But not perhaps as fast, but there is an enhanced movement in exactly the opposite direction towards enhanced interaction with patients that is completely identified, that has nuanced consent, that's constrained to population sizes, that the patients are involved in the process, and there is a move towards types of policy, particularly in biorepositories, that will have patients involved in understanding in working through the secondary consequences. So they instead of committing to, in the second case, a one-time consent, they commit to a process by which they can be part of it, and they can help, presumably, gain some benefit from this. So these, as you can see, don't really interact very well. So I keep pimping this quote out again and again because I love it so much. So Mitch Kapoor, Electronic Frontier Foundation, I'm sure the geeks in the neighborhood and the audience know about this, but this is a quote that I think is exactly on target for developing policy for large-scale data sharing networks, is that the design of the systems determines the type of politics that can take place in them, and designing a system is itself a political act. I think some of the technologies we're going to build here are disruptive. I mean, you can find out more from these repositories than you have ever been able to find out from, like, concentrated repositories before, particularly, racial, demographic breakdown, socioeconomic breakdown. It's really mind-blowing. So I think this is the thing to hold in foremost as we think about what our approaches to mediate these. So it's going to give my view only of some architectural design considerations that differ between centralized and federated approaches. Now, there's been a couple of papers in public health in particular how the failure of centralized repositories and how they are suggesting moving to at least some federated or less centralized approach. And I thought I'd go through them really quickly and little minuses and pluses. So in centralized, in general, this means that you submit to a centralized repository. There is a perception, at least, of the loss of control of local data. You must give it forth. You know, it's up there. So you have some policy there. In federated, you still have local control of data, but you don't necessarily have local control of who's looking at it. Centralized resources generally needs its own sustainability, its own resource money to manage it. These things don't happen organically. One of our former graduates, Sally Lead, wrote a number of papers on what supports collaboratories. But local sites still need their own money to be able to contribute, of course. So it's a bit of a breakdown. Where in federated, local sites need their own money. In general, you don't need a central resource. But of course, you look at something like CABIG, where you still do need like a registry management system or the DSIC or the NCI to just be there. Because if the NCI went away tomorrow, I doubt that CABIG would live on very long by itself. Unbalanced relationships. In centralized, I think there is this perception of what do I get by basing against what I must give up. And there is this concept of upfront expectation setting, which is a positive thing. It's that if you go through a collaborative, centralized approach to data sharing, well, you know, in theory, you buy into that, and you know, once you've bought into it, you hopefully bought into it with your eyes wide open. Whereas federated is kind of more of the peer-to-peer world of the internet, which is that you can choose pretty much in an abstract way of being a seed or a leech. And you can have a concept of ad hoc participation. You know, I could commit to being part of a network, a federated network, and if there's more than two, I could drop out and no one would be the, that'd be that. What could they do? So, you know, it's sort of a little more independent. Centralized, at least anticipated right now, is that access roles and security can be coordinated to some level, though there is, of course, the concept of data inbound data feed security versus user security, but there is at least some way you could actually place this. Whereas in federated, you have kind of decentralized access roles, though, you know, if you would combine this compared to the CA grid, there's a bit of the two, multiple points of security, but you do, though, have enhanced ability to secure your local commitment to what this is, and this gets to some all the other points I'll get in a minute. In centralized, and this is a total reach, I realize, is that, you know, if you do have a system, then the query speed and the data request are the function of how you've originally designed the architecture to support the work, and the size of the resource, and who's using it. Whereas in a federated network, query speed and data requests can remain constants, or at least as fast as the slowest network, depending on whether you have embargoed results or you have, more peer-to-peer, like BitTorrent distributed architectures. And the scalability, I think this is probably the key point here, is that if you lose money or commitment in a centralized resource, then it can vanish very, very quickly. And the history is littered with failed collaborations. And some of the ones we see now that are still going on are not 100%, but probably 70% based on massive influxes of cash over and over again. Now, with scalability and federated, to my guess, and this is just a presumption from what I've seen in I2B2 and others, the network can grow beyond local funding and local commitment because, again, things change. It is more reflective. And I2B2 has, which I'm sure most people have heard about, has somewhere near 50 partners in, I think, 20 countries now, and is growing in leaps and bounds. So these are just some considerations to one can think about. So to these are the very common policy issues that affect anything in clinical research, but these have different applications when you try to map them onto a network. So there's privacy, of course, of patients, of institutions, of researchers, of research projects, confidentiality to patients, identifiability of patients, of institutions. There is data use versus data access. So getting access to it is one thing, but what I use it for, what I publish it for, on it for is another thing entirely. Increasingly, there's this discussion of returning results, and there's about the obligation to the community. What if I, in my effort, find something critically important about you as a patient, an incidental finding about you have, an incredibly enhanced risk of something, how do I ethically and create a policy that I could reinform you? Should I have an obligation? Maybe I have an ethical obligation to return results about what is the data resources I'm building? Do I have a moral obligation to follow through on that? Consent, and we know now that one-time upfront consent is rapidly going out the window in favor of more nuanced or a matrix of consent, so you can opt in for some things, opt out of other things. Notification of secondary use, and kind of other questions of who benefits from this? Is it just me, my grant, what have you? When we talk about what is policy across networks, we're talking about instead of just IRB as an approach, we're talking about what is the stewardship, what is the obligation of these resources versus, and how is that folded into governance? Increasingly, of course, with things like dbGaP, we're seeing things like what is the intellectual property implications of being able to have this type of resource. Versus, and where should I draw the lines? Can I allow anyone to use this? And if so, why not? Should I allow Amgen to use this for free at the same cost as I allow any other researcher? So these things are coming up in any secondary use, but they have different relevance when you get to these very large resource scales. So to kind of ground this, I thought I'd give a quick view of some of the current evolving multi-institutional type of efforts. So one out of Chicago is the multi-institutional PACS radiological imaging study for secondary readings and clinical trials. This is over CA Grid. It is mostly out of, Argonne Labs? I never pronounced that. Argonne National Labs in Chicago, in collaboration with the University of Chicago. CA Grid, they're a big CA Grid house. It's fairly localized. It moves a lot of data around. It's limited to secondary researchers. The project that I've been working on is this prep to study a discovery of potential patient numbers to support clinical trial or aid in hypothesis generation. And this is just the ability to use query tools to structure hypotheses that could result in recruitment or secondary analysis, and is really focused on trying to have as much ability in the hands of the researcher as possible. This is the one that Jim Brinkley back there and others have worked on. This is a human studies descriptive metadata aggregate resource, which is HSMDB, which is kind of a federation of CA Grid and I2B2 out of UCSF, but with Ohio, and I think there's Penn, and there's Stanford, and there's about four or five others involved in this. Multi-institutional query capability to support pharmacovigilance. This is out of Boston Children's, and they've been doing it in Massachusetts. Quasi-real-time pharmacovigilance, pharmacosurveillance that they base on aggregating information from the emergency departments. And this is the new one that I'm working on now that is mostly I2B2, institutionally-based comparative effectiveness networks, to be able to actually look at things like readmission rates of patients based on discharges across sites to determine where, what is going on there. So these are just, all of these have, to some degree, money behind them. And all of these are really have very rich technical architectures, but all these also have is real challenges to how to actually deliver those data to end users and how to manage their policy across these systems. So I drew up this the other day. One thing that I think is presently happening, even though we know that there's technologies behind various pieces of this diagram, the main thing that is really enhancing collaborations, federated collaborations, or CA Grid collaborations, is this concept of shared expectations. We don't know what the consequences, the downstream secondary use of using aggregate de-identified data is, for example, but we continue in our collaboration because we think it's probably a good thing. We don't really have any encoded way to establish trust or security or auditability or anything right now. And so just to walk through the diagram, essentially, You know, patient data, it has IRB approval locally, be it de-identified in most cases or some limited data set. It is then pushed or made available, exposed, in an aggregate form, some form there. And then all the institutions are sort of in it together. And, you know, this is one of those examples that by which, you know, if you think it through, you think, well, how bad could that be? But the actual ability to query across multiple different competing institutions, demographics, race, ethnicity categories, and dispositions is dangerously interesting to people more interested than I am. And so right now, the fact that we only still have shared expectations there as a formalization of data use agreements is, I think, a huge gap in how we're trying to build and implement these systems. So this is kind of why. Right now, presently, in this country, by and large, we assume that all control begins with local IRB approval. You can't get a project off the ground in the University of Washington without this, obviously. Or if you are, you won't be here for very long. We also assume that we have very limited ability to control secondary downstream uses. We do not know who is going to use this yet. We are building it as informaticists because we are building it to some degree. typically, because of the local the policy and federated networks, we focus on the adherence to the law. You know, HIPAA comes first, absolutely, before anything. And then comes, combined to that, human subject protection, and then increasing the reduction of risk. And this last one, I think, is really kind of the complex, nebulous one that the IRB people don't really have a great idea from and need to be informed on ways to reduce risk. And, you know, Marchin, for example, has done some stuff in aggregate data presentation, which I think begins to, you know, change the way you can introduce these things. So the assessment generally is, you know, who's the owner and what does that mean? What are the uses, and then who are the users? And so we get to the users last, which unfortunately need to drive this whole thing. So some of the challenges is that, you know, we really have a dependence on, but with very varying interpretations of what anonymization versus de-identification actually means. There are some standards out that begin to apply for this, but because each of these type of resources comes from a local ecosystem with locally encoded data, with a whole history of how they did that with multiple different systems, how we apply de-identification, how we protocolize that, is one-offs. And if you think that IRBs are processing, the UW IRB office processes 40 IRBs a week, of which some two-thirds of them involve de-identification, they're way oversaturated in what this means, and willing to take your word for it that you're going to be HIPAA compliant, but that doesn't actually line up necessarily with everyone else's sites. So very hard, you know, since we have local implementations, when you try to harmonize semantics of this, it becomes very complex. The other challenge is that, like, how do you build a coordinating data use agreement, which sounds great, versus an individual IRB approval, which we're comfortable with, versus a project IRB, which we're more comfortable with. This middle one, building institutional resource, is at least, you know, there's probably 20 sites in the country that are doing this at different levels, but the IRBs are much more comfortable with having a person, you know, or a group with a certain fixed N of patients and certain fixed users. We move from the last to the middle one has been painful, and moving up to this coordinated data use agreements is going to be very painful. So they're very still nascent, and they're of limited scope.
Flesh that one out. Mm-hmm. I want you to correct me if I'm wrong or tell the story yourself. When we did the project, the information exchange pilot project, mm-hmm. there, planned to have a data use agreement between three sites. Mm-hmm. And that never happened, right?
Yeah. Because
that's an interesting story.
Well, you know, University of California can do that, and they are doing that across four sites, but we're not in California. I mean, simple, like, dumb, relatively mundane reasons like that are the next step to getting there. Now, CA Big, I mean, NCI, I mean, you know, if you're an NCI site, you know, or you're a cancer site, maybe you have a better approach forwards there. But when we talk about things that go across models, institution to community, to state, to country, I mean, how do you move from an IRB, which does not know, assumes that you cannot control where the data is going to go, to a data use agreement where you're all in it together? I'm really excited to see this. Now, certain countries within Europe are beginning to do this. I think we're very broken still. But yes. So, and this is kind of, you know, I mean, I'm kind of banging on the same points again, but there, you know, part of the reason for this kind of slow moved maybe institutional IRBs for repositories and things is that there is massive institutional sensitivity. Group Health has the VDW. It doesn't really let anyone but Group Health use it because Group Health doesn't want everyone to know anything about Group Health except Group Health people. And they even have some control over how you publish on data on this because this is 14 million patients. This is very powerful data. But as we move towards, you know, a meaningful use and other things, these type of systems, if they ever become accessible, are potentially extremely disruptive. They're exactly what are needed to make policy decisions about funding. Hence, potentially very expensive, very damaging. There is, though, a common desire to use them, but it's not a great idea to be the first one to use them. Everyone's really happy to see the things that we've managed to get done, and they think it's great, and you know, they ask for the IRB, and we're all equally unimpressed by how limited it is. But there's some sort of groundswell to this, and again, there are these drivers. But Harvard took 2 years to establish their business processes to do something extremely restricted, and I think everyone's kind of waiting to see that that's kind of okay, but we'll go any further. So there are unknown levels of risk that are inherent in extracting all and delivering and analyzing modalities of data. So in addition to things, you know, like identifiability of patients, you know, there is the concept of finding out what research projects are underway and how well it's going. What is the quality of care? How many deaths have you had for preterm infants in the last 6 months? Things like that. And everyone's 5 years ago, people were like afraid to be on CNN. Now they're afraid to be on Twitter. I don't want to leave this conference. I half expect to leave this and be Twittered about something like this and go, oh, great. You know, here we go. Nick's proposing that we have different policies to support this. It's a very, very dangerous environment. But there is also less knowledge of how to actually manage trust and risk in delivering the data. So I'm using aggregate de-identified data, as mentioned, much, and other things. Other people are doing de-identified data, marts and warehouses. Other people are doing just summary data. Other people are doing delivered limited data sets. The technology to get to this final step is pretty limited now, though CA Grid does have quite a bit. So in combination with this is that there is a lot of challenges of how you build your process and policy in that still maintains utility. As I mentioned before, we have uneven harmonization of IRBs across sites, and this has a big challenge when you start getting into the semantics about being able to coordinate and align these data at a large scale. We need to develop policy that actually is grounded on semantic models that is common to be able to advance this work. And there isn't many examples of this. So this kind of a wordy sentence, limited systems available to normalize the complex resource-to-researcher relationships. We don't know how to meet research end-user needs in a way that you can tie semantics to a policy that allow them to do that in an unfettered way. We have a window shopping model. We have a very kind of a request and delivery model that is very highly restricted. We haven't really got to the point of resources that's really well done there. And this is my hypothesis, is that I still think the best researcher use is a governed approach that puts them in the query seat, that actually puts them in the ability to make their own requests, do their own decisions, and then with the right processes to support that they aren't going to go to Twitter or otherwise misuse this, then we trust them. We build a way to let them trust them, and we put in processes that we audit them. We trust them, and so right now, for example, even though the repository that I have is technically not human subjects, it's massively locked down because of this business intelligence. It is exempt from IRB. It's exempt from human subject protection. But there's a lot of concern about the fact that it can still get really interesting things out of it. And we've got to be careful about getting those interesting things. So so this is, paralyzing our colleagues, friends, and our colleagues and others, is that what we need to be able to see as we determine how to build the architecture for these systems so that they're used is how you intersect the policy ethics and data utility. HIPAA's not going away, though it might be modified, HIPAA 2 has been modified, but there may be variations on this. And so, we can assume that regulations are going to be the floor of data sharing policy. We'll always have them there. We must always assume that we have, we toe the line to regulations. I want to make sure that we bring things, standardized terminologies to these policy and regulations as much as possible. So if you want to take a look at this, the HITSB IS 158 clinical research data sharing cases, and it's very beginning on interinstitutional large-scale data sharing that is different from meaningful use because it is research-based. We must tie these standards and this policy to the interpretation of HIPAA as long as HIPAA is around, and we must tie all the above to secure and auditable systems. I mean, we must have identity of whoever are using these, or at least if we, well, I think we should have identity of who are using this, but we should definitely track how they're being used so that we have a way to react. The problem is right now is that, you know, if you just start going down the protocol line and implementing these processes and HIPAA, you wind up inadvertently lowering utility, and you might actually begin to harm populations. One interpretation of HIPAA would mean that if you remove anything that is potentially identifiable, you can remove entire communities. Like at the UW, we did a little test on this, and I think it was 2% of all of patients had to be removed because they had a rare enough disease diagnosis that in a very dark world could probably be re-identifiable. Well, that worked out to be 40,000-50,000 patients. That's a very large number of people, and that is a disservice to what we're doing, and I think it goes against everything we're trying to do here in the first place. In the same, more simple thing, is that we have to render zip codes right now, and I'm sure people know this, is that we have to drop the last three digits of any zip code off if you live in a county with less than 20,000 people. So that's fine. So now we have 18 counties that fit within 0000. Well, so does California. So does Nevada. You know, we suddenly have these numbers that don't reflect where populations exist. We don't have representation of what we're trying to do about building these repositories because we are towing this protection line without any understanding of how the policy can be made to support it. So what we really need to do is we need to develop policy that obviously plans for responding to the worst case, but it hopes for the best case, and this is going to need to change over time. Because, you know, like CA Big, you know, it's been going for 10 years, these systems have been going probably less than that, this is still on the edge of R&D. It is not truly a production-type world. So the project that I was lucky enough to be involved in is called CICTR, and it's transferring slowly into a project called Home Run. And CICTR was cross-institutional clinical translational research. And Home Run is Hospital Medical Environment Reengineering Project. And this is a project that was purely tried to just jump right in and do this. And we're at 4.2 million patients right now, heavily de-identified. And this is California and Washington. It's UW, UCSF, and UC Davis. By Q1 of next year, we'll have four states. We'll be going to Michigan, Penn, and seven institutions. And we will probably have approximately approaching 10 million patients if it was live, if it was being used. And so, you know, it may or may not be. This is based on I2B2 and Shrine. And so it has been a very version-crippling process where you have to keep everyone in alignment of the technology stacks and the security and so forth. We have each of the sites has a local IRB because this is all we could really do 2 years ago, which seemed at one point seemed impossible then, and it's beginning to change a little bit. And we have kind of an ad hoc DUA. We have a common expectation that these three sites are in the project, and thus we're going to move forwards. Each of the sites is one way, de-identified, obfuscated, aggregated, and blurred. So utility is just dropping like a rock. But there's a lot of patients there, so that's good. We've redacted and zeroed out classes of sensitive populations, and we have developed lowest common denominator, common terminology mappings, and user interfaces across the three sites. So at least the experience of using these approaches the same, and they are. Even though it is purely a demonstration project, it is increasingly versions of this are in use in UC schools, and versions of this are in use in Harvard. And a lot of people are looking at this as at least one approach to begin to open the door to the right discussion about how you'd actually build policy relationships there. And so the use cases that drove us was anonymized cohort discovery for clinical trial recruitment, with the perception that if you could determine in a large population size that instance of rare disease existed, you could begin to find rare or orphan populations that may otherwise be excluded from recruitment. Unfortunately, once we started doing the IRB, we went to render those patients right out again. So we had to protect them for their own good. So we couldn't find them to actually help them. This is the targets, though, this has been an interesting thing, is that the users of this have been the research users, informaticians, terminologists, and increasingly comparative effectiveness researchers. I'm going to why that's important. So one of my colleagues, Ping, I've been discussing trying to Ping's a graduate of the program and postdoc in ITHS now, of how you actually build processes that both meet end user needs, address policy, and still instrument things at the same time. So this is based on the software engineering life cycle. I know we're into Scrum and Agile now these days, but this actually works as a model for how you begin to carve out the future. And I won't go through it too far. I'll point out a few things of how the policy I would like to see this evolve and how it's gone, is that you see that, starting from the top right, is that building a process to do this, the shared expectations, is this build and maintain partnerships. So we had to define the data needs, the structure, the delivery, and the use. Then we had to define the technical requirements that supported that in the bottom quadrant. Then we had to build the architecture. Then we had to evaluate it, train it, and market it. And then we had to do that again, and we did it again, and we did it again. Now we're in the fourth cycle here. And finally, we are transitioning into something where the model of what we need to do this is beginning to be met by people who come on board. We didn't need to, they aren't finding their way through as much to what they need to do at their leg. They can go, okay, well, I need a terminologist, I need a governance person, I need IRB support, I need a de-identification target, I need a technical architecture, I need a lot of firewalling. And so we went through this, we basically started from the kickoff, we did interoperability, we met and we discussed this. Then we went on to discuss the common requirements for data sharing, and we got IRBs. Then we developed very limited focus within the IRBs for this. Then we established the de-identification methods. And every single one of these things was ad hoc and very frustrating. But I think now, as we work to build policy across networks, we sort of need a similar approach. We need to make sure that we have the quadrants of something like this in place, and we need to iteratively start with risk-neutral policy approaches and then add to that, because we can't, I probably could not walk into the IRB today and start talking about, seven-site competitive effectiveness research stratification of readmittance rates. I would be met by 9 to 10 months of reevaluation, but I could probably start something smaller there. So that's kind of just lessons that I've been learning on this. And I just want to point out to the informatics people that though this is soft science in some ways, this is a very, very broad soft science. So in addition to AMIA, LC, which is going to be at AMIA, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues Group, the People and Organizational Issues Group, there are a number of large-scale efforts around the country that are really having intersections between informatics, data sharing, and policy that are really trying to, I think in many cases, actually do this. And so demonstration by example. So the eMERGE study, this is a group health led thing in part with others that's got ethical, legal, social issues. That's patient consenting for genomic data sharing. CTSA, of which there are now 56 institutions, so you can't go probably more than 200 miles from a CTSA in this country anymore. All of them have in common ethics, informatics, and standards groups. They have work groups on omics, data sharing, policy. And permissions and ontologies of that nature. They have SEER, we have our local center here. This is the Center for Excellence in Ethical, Legal, and Social Research. This is the Bioethics and Humanities Department that is right around the corner here, headed by Wiley Burke. We have the CA Hub, which is the Cancer Human Biobank, and the DSIC, which I'll be speaking about in the previous section here in about 2 weeks. This is the Data Standards Interoperability Committee, I think is what it stands for, which is trying to really look at policy to support NCI, CA Big, CA Grid work. And we have SHARP, which is the Shared Health Advanced Research Projects, ONC, NIH. And these have been a number that are trying to demonstrate and implement these around the country. So across all these, there's actually, as I mentioned at one point earlier, there's a key amount of funding involved here and a lot of people. And across all of these, there is, I think, increasingly more obvious focus on actual deliverables and milestones that actually test this. And so I think we're, in some ways, I think we're done talking. I think we're actually trying to do this, but we're not good enough to actually do it well yet. We're just going to get it going to do it. So, slide I borrowed. As you're developing policy, this is lessons learned that may come from the healthcare reform, which seems like a long time ago, is that you may not be able to achieve consensus yet, but you can at least achieve standards to terminologies, to privacy, to de-identification. You may not be able to accommodate everyone else's preferences and values, but you do need to actually go have advocates and stakeholders that will allow you to test what they are. You need to build this to end-user uses, and actually, obviously, you need to build this to actually affect research. Sometimes, though, you need to make policy decisions based on values, evidence, and best available options. And in my case, that meant lowering expectations and starting again. And I think this is the key point, is that anything we do today is going to probably almost guaranteed not to be our solution tomorrow. We've got so much moving, so many moving targets in this, is that you need to plan for revisiting of these efforts. So I think that is it. That's my soft science lecture.
So thank you, Nick. Open it up to questions, but I want to start with one. I was really struck by your all throughout the talk, and then the slide that you had, the focus on politics, how it seems to be ubiquitous and underlie everything here. I think what's possible, what's not, how to go about it. So I have one question in particular related to when you were talking about assessing the risk of data sharing, and you said that potentially available data are exactly what is needed to influence policy. And so I was curious on influence policy in what way, on the basis of what data, and who will frame the questions, and is this comparative effectiveness research or something else? Or
I'm not a researcher of that form, but I mean, just the examples that I think will affect policy. If you have the ability to have demonstrated data-driven research that shows disease disparities, then your disease advocacy groups will have a lot of clout and will probably be lobbying for greater support in those things. I mean, I think the moment that we actually see population-level effects of large-scale data sharing that can be taken up as efforts, we'll see, a whole bunch we'll see some side effects. I mean, cancer has been around for a long time, obviously. I mean, and there's advocacy groups for that. But some of these rare diseases or mental disorders or things that can be at the large scale, I can see people rallying behind this. But I think the other people who are going to affect policy are people who are really trying to look at how to enhance quality within institutions and are looking for ways to allow such better participation to support that, and then a mechanism to reintroduce the outcomes of research networks that may then get back to quality. And any meaningful use is out there. It's very, it's fairly limited, and it doesn't seem to address how the results of research will inform meaningful use. I think this is an open area. I think it's an obvious place to be able to affect how we actually make better clinical information sharing, is that we actually try to determine what the policy on research data sharing can be brought back into healthcare delivery. And I mean, I don't know if I'm going to see it in my lifetime, but I know there will be a lot more discussion if these resources became more available to the right people. We only need, I think, a few people who are very loud to be able to do well with these systems. Get the director of the NIH using one of these systems, I'm sure we'd see a lot of policy change pretty quickly. So that's my thoughts.
So I was just struck in your answer when you said this, the first part of your answer focused on the demographics and being able to provide data about underserved populations or specific minority mm-hmm. populations or rare disease groups and so on. And that's very low-level basic research. I mean, that's not high-level, sophisticated, complex analysis of, it's very striking. Open it up to other questions.
Yes.
I'd just like to ask you, the extent to which you've been looking at the attributes in the individual health record, the electronic health record, as attributes of an individual, and which of those attributes are most relevant and have common conventions or abstraction into population health databases such as you've been describing here?
That's the big question. Well, what we've done, and well, the project that I've done, which is disease neutral, though we tried to focus on diabetes and cardiovascular disease, was very frankly, we had to determine what we could get. We mapped these to the common standards with the assumption that this is going to need to be revisited for quality. So right now, the network I've got is demographics, disease diagnoses, disposition data with diagnoses, limited laboratory tests and limited medications. We don't, limited labs and meds because of many problems. But we're trying to determine, what I think the approach we're trying to take is that there will be a common high-level view of rich data, but in order to really support some of these networks, we'll need to have supplementary, highly curated data sources that can add curation to this use, be it disease-specific, medication-specific, surgical-specific, things like that. But right now, it's structured data. We're, I think, quite a long ways from being able to have annotated NLP data for data sharing. This is very structured. And I know full well that our data sources were pretty suspect. Here at the UW, I'm happy to say that the new version of this is going to have 1.6 million patients from Amalga, and there's been a massive effort for curation there. So we're at least going to be able to use that focus on quality to support our quality. The other sites have different processes. I mean, this is a thing. I think any question you ask of these systems, you need to, be them NCIC systems, whatever, you need to know that that is just the technical part of it. The rest of using and accessing this data is going to still require very smart people with very analytic skills to test quality and do something with that.
Other questions? Well, thank you again, Nick.
Thanks, Fred.